on the eighth day, my neurologist came in with a pad. He was writing his stuff down. And he said, okay. He said, I'm getting her paperwork ready. We're getting ready to release her. And they said, you said, you know, you said it's going to be 6 to 8 months. And he said, there's really no medical explanation, but she's ready. She has a will to live.
Hey guys, check out the 2023 Street Cop Conference, April 23rd through the 28th, Gaylord Convention Center. It's going to be the event of the year. Keynote speakers include Rob O'Neill, the guy who killed Bin Laden, Kyle Carpenter, the youngest living Medal of Honor recipient, Navy SEAL Jason Redmond, Fox News host Tommy Lahren, Marine Corps Special Forces and Leadership Coach Cody Alford, Sheriff Wayne Ivey, Sheriff David Clark, and Sheriff Mark Lamb. It's going to be one hell of an event. And on top of that, we have all of our instructors and additional instructors from other companies going to be at the event, giving you everything they know for you to have a successful career and get the results you want to get in the field as a police officer. On top of attending the event, you'll get face-to-face time with every instructor attending the event, and all the keynote speakers will spend time with you. We got special events all week, giveaways, nightlife. It's going to be really, really worth your time, energy, and effort. I promise you, you will not regret it for a second. To register for the conference, check out streetcop.com, click conference, and everything you need will be there on the homepage. If you are looking for a room, just click book a room. The block has been sold out at the Gaylord Opryland Convention Center, but there are many hotels nearby within a walking distance of the event. You don't want to miss out on this opportunity. We will see you there.
You training to be a street cop?
Hey guys, welcome to this episode of the Street Cop Training Podcast. I'm your host, founder and CEO of Street Cop Training. My name is Dennis Bonino, and we're just blessed to have Michelle on here today. This is Michelle Mehr, spelled M-E-H-R. And you may not know her name right away. Some of you probably do, but certainly we'll know her story because I think the whole world has seen this video. It is one of the most graphic, earlier caught on camera videos of somebody really significantly assaulting a police officer. But before we get to that, I really suggest you guys tune in. But thank you for being here, Michelle. Appreciate you taking the time today to share your story and give us a little context to who Michelle Mehr is.
Michelle Mehr, the video that he's referring to, my name at that time was Michelle Jeter. That was an ex-married name. Notice I said ex-married name. And it was in August of 1997. The perpetrator was in a blue van, had his daughter on the side of the road. I stopped him for speeding.
I think people already know what story this is.
Okay.
This woman from this video we're here. But before we go into that, tell us about your law enforcement background, maybe where you grew up, why you wanted to become a cop, things like that.
I started law enforcement in 1995 in Carthage, Texas, which was my hometown. It's also where the incident happened. I worked there. And I was promoted later to assistant chief of police, worked there until 2010. Then I left and worked for the LEOCA program of the FBI, going across the country and speaking on officer safety, street survival and such. Later, while I was doing that work, I met my now husband who lives in Jackson, Tennessee, and we had a long distance relationship for a while. I ended up marrying him. He retired from Tennessee Bureau of Investigation and then ran for sheriff in Madison County, Tennessee. I ended up going to work for him at the rank of major and worked for him for 8 years.
Did you know somebody at that place to get in or no? You didn't know anybody? I'm joking.
Exactly. And now as I tell people, it's my joke for the day. I am now a domestic engineer. That means I stay home and I cook and I just enjoy life. And when I want to go and do something, I go and do something. I think I've earned that over 27 years of policing.
I sounds like you earned it.
I feel like I did. So I really enjoy this new domestic engineering gig.
So is it what's the most significant danger you face as a domestic engineer? Dropping a spoon on your big toe?
That, or if I actually bump the oven. you know, the burner on the oven, and I get a little, you know, arm burn or hand burn. You know, you got to be real careful with stuff like that.
It's a dangerous job. I mean,
it is.
Only a select few can do it.
Exactly. Not everybody's cut out for it.
Well, obviously, you've had a lot of time in law enforcement, and I'm sure that everything you've done has been appreciated across the board. But you said you were speaking on behalf of the FBI for LEOCA. What does LEOCA stand for?
Law enforcement officers killed and assaulted. I was a national instructor for them, and they called me and asked me to come to work for them because of my video. And they stated that my video was the number one training video in the world. I said, well, when I do something, I try to do it right.
Well, I guess it's that time to go into that video. How much time did you have on the job before you got to that part of your career? 2 years, right?
Coming up 2.5.
You went through an academy. How long was your academy before that incident occurred?
Can I remember back that far?
I don't know. You were punched in the face quite a few times. I don't know what happened.
Exactly. I did a nighttime academy, and it was four days a week, 4 hours an evening. And each section, it was three different sections. So it was 30 weeks.
You know, the reason I ask about that is because I'm sure as you're beginning to pull back the curtains on street cop training, to give a little context of why I'm so motivated to do the work that we do and have the instructor we have in the field is because, and I'll say this many times to my detriment, and I've repeated that phrase many times in the past year, the training we get is not good. And I don't think anybody in the world can argue that there is a different side to that. And people say, well, I went to this academy. They did a good job at this academy. Well, that's cool. Because I think in the country probably have 1,000 academies, if not more.
Right.
And most of them are doing a pretty crappy job. And we're not sitting around begging them to change. We're just bringing something new to the market. And some of the things we say are like, hey, swinging a stick at a bag and screaming get back for 40 hours is never going to happen in real life. I have no idea why we're doing that in a training capacity. So I've been in this gig for about 22 years. This will be my 22nd year. And I've done work and I've seen a lot of stuff. The only time I see somebody pull out a stick and start swinging it usually is followed up by them getting their ass whooped. So when we say that these sticks are literally a joke, but we spend 40 hours in the academy or 10 or 12 or 15, 20, having your friend stand very still holding a bag, and you're going to do different kind of draws on this thing and then yell, get back, and hit the bag over and over again. The reality of that actually working in the field is complete bullshit. And what we're saying is, so that guy should just go and take a hike. We should start bringing in some Brazilian jiu-jitsu instructors. And if we can, if we're lucky enough to get ones that tailor for law enforcement. But outside of that, I think that's where the conversation begins of like, all right, pressure points don't work. Let's face facts. Let's all forego this bullshit that we're all so romantic about in the past and bring some people in that actually know how to fight and can teach us how to fight and do controlling maneuvers, moves and stuff. That's a little my context, Michelle.
Right. And, you know, you look at my incident. What you learn in the academy about deadly force. Somebody draws a gun, that's deadly force, right? Somebody draws an arm, a hand. Does it make you think? Are you right then in fear for your life? Of course, I don't, and I can't go back and say anything on that part because I don't remember that traffic stop one bit whatsoever. I remember probably 10, 15 minutes beforehand. And I woke up in a hospital 6 days later.
So walk us through what happened. Obviously, you saw the video.
I did a while later. Yes. I stopped the guy for speeding. He was traveling 64 in a 55 mile per hour zone. And for whatever reason, this is where I have to kind of wonder if he just made me feel like he may be transporting something or doing something illegal, or if I smell marijuana, I don't know, but I asked him for consent to search his vehicle. And he granted consent, which, you know, luckily I did have the video because there were very few video cameras in vehicles in 1997. So I searched his vehicle, passenger side first, then I went to the driver's side, the back seat of the driver's side. And from what I figured by my reactions, I found the marijuana. Came out, told him to put his hands on the vehicle, which what I could not see, what you can see in the video, but what I could not see while I was bent over looking in the vehicle were the motions he was making to his 10-year-old child. And he was already planning what he was going to do. He was motioning for her to step back off the side of the road, which she was already on the shoulder, but he was motioning for her to get out of the way because he planned on doing what he did already. So I walked up to him. I was walking towards him with my handcuffs out, and I told him to put his hands on the car. He went to put his hands on his van, and I said, no, on that car over there, which was my patrol car. He went in a motion as if he was going to comply, but he never stepped that 1 foot forward. It was still behind him. So when I stepped forward with the handcuff, he spun on that foot and hit me in the nose area of the face and knocked me to the ground. According to doctors later, they said once my head hit the back of my head hit the pavement, that I was out. So he beat me. He jumped on top of me. He continued to beat me. He attempted to take my firearm. It would not come out. It was a dual retention holster. He got up, slung the blood off his hands, and he looked at me and said, baby, I can't go back to jail. Told his daughter to get in the car, and they took off. Fortunately, a passerby, one stopped and got on my radio to call for help, and another local couple saw that he was leaving, and they took off. It was a one-ton Ford pickup. Now, only in Texas are you going to get a one-ton Ford pickup pulling a flatbed trailer, chasing a perpetrator down the road and calling 911. But he never made it out of our county, and he got caught probably 6-7 miles down the road.
Who caught him?
Highway Patrol. Highway Patrol and sheriff's cars were right behind him. Huh?
Did Highway Patrol have cameras at that time?
If they did, I didn't see. Yeah, they did. Yes, they did. Yes, they did have it.
Did he give them a hard time once he was stopped?
No, because they stopped. And as soon as the Highway Patrol got him stopped, there were sheriff's deputies surrounding as well. And all of them got out with guns drawn. And he just immediately threw his hands up.
It was brought into custody.
Correct. And he's still locked up.
I'm going to ask you about that in a minute.
Yes.
What happened then? So obviously you don't know what happened, but because you don't remember it, but what did they tell you happened? What was the next thing that transpired?
Okay. So the ambulance was en route, and the ambulance crew gets, well, I had one of my officers that was up the road. We worked a lot of drug interdiction together, and, you know, he was in a panic, you know, because of me. Ambulance gets there. They're trying to get me ready. They need to intubate me because my oxygen level was in the teens. And they couldn't get me intubated because I was swelling so fast. The passerby that stopped, he was from Massachusetts. No, I'm sorry. He was from Pennsylvania. And he kept in touch with me over years. But he said, I have never in my life watched somebody swell. He said, with every beat of my heart, he said, I was getting bigger. My face was getting bigger. My left eye, it blew out my orbital. So my left eye was actually hanging out. And I swelled so bad, so fast that it swelled my eye back in the vicinity of where it was supposed to go. EMS got me, loaded me up as quick as they could, got me into the hospital. And the doctor at the hospital told me later that he said, you know, give or take 30 seconds, he said, we couldn't have saved you.
Wow.
So it was critical. A lot of brain swelling, a lot of facial swelling, a lot of broken and displaced parts of my face. I was a mess, I guess you'd say.
How lucky, in some sense, were you that these people happened to be at the right place at the right time to do what they could to help you, right? It the radio life. Call.
Life and death. I'm very, very fortunate because if the gentleman from Pennsylvania had not gotten on my radio, if, you know, they waited even for the for somebody to get there, you know, it would have they'd have to wait for somebody to get on the phone and call into dispatch. You know, who's going to call? Because, you know, you take 30 seconds, you look at 30 seconds, give or take 30 seconds, life or death, that's a very, very small window. So it made all the difference in the world to have a passerby stop and immediately get on my radio and call for help. He actually met the offender. I mean, the first officer met the offender on the overpass, but did not know that he was meeting him, which I wasn't worried about. I was worried about
him. You're at the hospital. You wake up 6 days later. You don't know what you're doing there.
Correct.
What did that look like? What was like, who was there when you woke up? You know, what did you learn about it? And what's that journey like?
My husband at the time, he was sitting in the chair next to the bed. And I'd been flown to Shumpert, and it was in Shreveport, Louisiana. And my husband looked at me. He could see that I was opening my eyes and looking around. And he said, hey, baby, are you okay? I said, yeah, I'm fine. He said, do you know where you are? Well, you know, we've all been in hospitals, so we know the decor. And I had balloons and flowers and IVs. You know, I said, I'm in the hospital. He said, yeah. He said, do you know which one? No. He said, do you know why you're here? I said, I'm sick. You know, I'm trying to use good deductive reasoning. And he talked to me, got the nurses and so forth. And, you know, they told me over a period of time that I'd had facial surgery. And they told me that I was there, that I'd gotten hurt at work. They didn't want me to go into any kind of shock or go backwards because my progress, as they said, was tremendous. Because originally, when I got to the hospital and got checked and in intensive care, of course, I told the family that it would be touch and go for a bit. They were going to monitor me. And they said, be prepared because she's going to be here a minimum of 6 to 8 months. And it will be at least 6 to 8 weeks before we can do any kind of surgery to reconstruct her face. So they said, be prepared. It's going to be a lengthy stay. And we don't know how long it will be till she wakes up or if she wakes up. And they ended up the second day that I was in there in ICU. Yeah, I guess nobody told them I was hard-headed because I really am. But they said in just one quick motion, I reached up and grabbed the intubation tube and I jerked it out. I extubated myself and the panic sets in. Nurse calls a doctor. Everybody panics. The doctor says, is she breathing on her own? They said, yes, she is. So maybe she doesn't need it. You know, monitor her and leave it out unless she needs it. So they did such. And then on the fourth day, the doctors came in and said, we're getting ready to take her back for surgery. And they said, you said it's going to be 6 to 8 weeks. And they said, she's ready. You know,
wow.
We can't really explain why, but she's ready. So they did one lengthy reconstructive surgery and reconstructed my face in I don't know how long because I was out. And that was on the fourth day. The sixth day I woke up and they weren't sure if I would know anybody or know anything, but I did. I knew people that came in. Of course, I didn't know what had happened to me. I was doing fine. I was a little tired, you know, with medication and so forth, but That was on the sixth day. And on the eighth day, my neurologist came in with a pad. He was writing his stuff down. And he said, okay. He said, I'm getting her paperwork ready. We're getting ready to release her. And they said, you said it's going to be 6 to 8 months. And he said, there's really no medical explanation, but she's ready. She has a will to live. And she can heal just as well at home with people that care about her as she can here in the hospital. So I went home on the eighth day. And 2 months from when the incident happened, I went back out on full patrol.
Wow. So besides yourself going through this thing, who do you think, maybe one or two people that it affected the most more than it affected you? Now you're going back to work. Was it your husband, your mother?
My mother and my dad. And, you know, my husband, but he was law enforcement as well. But it was really difficult on him. And I know he spent many of days walking in the prayer garden of the church area. And it affected the whole community because, you know, I was born and raised there. And my family was born and raised there. It's one of those towns, it's kind of funny because it's one of those towns that people can move in and move there. But as far as the people that are from there, those people that came in and moved in, they'll never be from there. They can live there 30 years, but they'll say, well, they moved here from Mississippi. They're not from here, you know. So it's a pretty tight-knit town. And I had, you know, multiple churches. You know, I was being prayed for at multiple churches. I had flowers from all over town till the florist ran out of flowers. I had a multitude of support. They said before the helicopter lifted off at the hospital that there were over 300 people standing outside the hospital at the liftoff. And that was a short period of time. But, you know, back then you had your scanner days where everybody had a police scanner and all the channels were available. You know, it's not encrypted like a lot of places are today, but people knew and they knew whoever it was. They knew whoever it was and they were there. But my mother, she was the one that was most affected by it because they lived, as the crow flies, they live about a mile and a half from the hospital. So every time a helicopter would come in, you could just see her freeze and shake, worrying about, you know, remembering back to what happened to me.
Did your mother ever express to you what that did to her? You ever talk about it?
She did. To some extent, my parents obviously did not want me going back to work. Obviously, for, you know, whatever reason. I can't imagine why, you know, just because I almost got killed on the side of the road. But they were supportive because they wanted me to be happy. And they knew that was what was in my heart and what I wanted to do. And, you know, my deal was that man beat me down, left me for dead, left me gurgling on the side of the road. But the one thing I was not going to let him win, I wasn't going to let him take my livelihood. That's what I had in my heart to do. That's what I wanted to do. And I was not going to allow him or anybody else stop me from doing it. So I went back out on the street. And of course, they told me to take it easy for a little while. They made me work day shift because they thought they could watch me and, you know, keep their thumb on me. And they told me the first week I came back, do not stop anybody. Okay. And I tried. I really tried not to stop anybody. But I think it was the fifth day I thought, you know, I saw a car going around near the same area of where I was injured. I said, you know I'm not going to stop anybody. Let me see if I can get somebody to stop this car. So I radioed to the sheriff's deputy, and they were looking at another car, and I couldn't get anybody to pay attention to me. So I got in behind the car, and the car was watching the sheriff's deputy looking at a car ahead of them, and they rolled the stop sign. So I stopped the car, and it was a female, pretty close to my size. I asked for and received consent to search her vehicle because I noticed, you know, some phones that she had in there, the different types of phones back in the day that were pretty well involved in the drug trafficking. And I noticed her bag, the one bag that she had in the back seat of her car that wasn't big enough for a woman going for a weekend anywhere. So I got consent, searched the vehicle, and found her 44 pounds of marijuana. And she was actually the car that the sheriff's office had stopped. They were her protection for the load. So they got, I think, a couple of blunts that they had, but they got the firearms for the load. So they stopped him. So we got all of them that day. But first, one of my guys that showed up to back me up, he walked up to me as I was opening the trunk of the car, and he said, "What are you doing? It's almost time to get off the work. What are you doing stopping a car?" I said, "Probably fix have to arrest her." He said, "What for?" I said, "This right here." And I picked up the bag, and sure enough, it was marijuana. And that changed everything. But I get back to the office, and I get scolded for stopping. But anyway, they knew that they couldn't control anything else I did. So just let her do what she does, and it'll be all right.
When did you make the decision to go back to work?
Soon as I got home. It was like, how long am I going to be here? You know, how long am I going to be off before I can go back to work? Of course, it wasn't going to happen right then because I still had a multitude of doctor's appointments. You can't imagine the doctor's appointments I had to go to, you know, between my ear, nose, and throat specialist who did my surgery. I had my eye doctor, had my neurologist, and I was back and forth, and I knew I'd have to be released. So I talked to the, as soon as I went to the neurologist, I asked him how long I would have to be off. And he said, "It's going to be a while." And I finally, you know, after the 2 month, it was right at 2 months. And I said, I feel fine. I really want to be released. You know, I'd lost a bunch of weight because I couldn't eat for a while, you know, with my jaw and facial surgery and everything else. But mentally, I was good. I had to go through. It's amazing the number of tests that you have to go through after an injury like that to show that you're up to snuff to go back to work. You know, the grip test, the psychologicals, the you name it. I had to take it. They asked many questions, you know, from middle school to college. You know, they'd ask you, you know, what's your highest level of education, college, and then they would go back and ask questions through everything, you know, checking to make sure that my brain was functioning on all cylinders, I suspect.
How much pain do you think you were in then as you were going through these procedures? You woke up, obviously, didn't remember feeling any pain, but once you wake up, you're in this hospital bed, you're in probably an intensive care unit, I'd have to guess. And what was the pain like? What's some of the pain you endured? And to add on to that, what's some of the pain you live with now, if any? That's physical.
Okay. Now, I'm different than a whole lot of people. Okay. I have an unreal tolerance for pain. I mean, it's really off the chart. Whenever I got home from the hospital, you know, they'd sent me home with medicine and so forth. And I was staying at my parents' house. And my husband was staying there too, but I had to have someone with me all the time. And my mother brought me some medicine. I took it. And she came back in however many hours later. She says, "Time for your medicine again." And I said, What kind of medicine are you giving me?" And she said, "Well, it's a pain medicine." I said, "I don't want it. I'm not going to take pain medicine." I didn't take any more. I said, "I can manage. I can deal with it." Because I feel that the more you deal with, the less it affects you later. And I still to this day will not take pain medicine. I don't care if I've had surgery or anything else. No pain medicine. It's a big deal if I take Tylenol. That means I hurt. So, yeah, it was, I had some pain. I'm not going to tell you I didn't, but whenever the damage to the left side of my face, it severed the nerve that runs from your ear across your cheek. So I had very little feeling on the left side of my face. It was just numb. And still, I still don't have all of the feeling back. I regained all the movement back. And they told me within 6 months, whatever I had back would be all I would ever get. And it still had, the left side of my face still kind of feels like you've been to the dentist and the numbing is kind of trying to wear off, but it's not all the way off. And that's the way the left side of my face feels. I can touch certain places on my face and it's tender to this day, but it's nothing that, it's nothing that cannot be dealt with.
Hey guys, if you're enjoying the Street Cop Podcast, do us a favor and give us a review on iTunes or Spotify, wherever you're listening to us. Tell a friend. We don't charge anything for the episodes. We appreciate your support. Check us out on any social platform by putting into the search bar Street Cop Training. Give us a follow. We have a lot of free content coming out every single day that you might not catch here on the podcast. And it's important for you to be able to do your job more professionally. And we also entertain you as well.
Any other physical pain, like difficulty breathing, headaches, things like that from the incident? It's great.
No, only when there's a certain headache that I will get and I know when I get it, but I have a mouthpiece that was built for me at the dentist, a hard mouthpiece. And what it's caused from is, see, my cheek and my jaw were not next to my ear. So they had to rebuild my jaw. And because of that, you know, anytime you have any jaw surgery or anything, it weakens your jaw to some extent. So my jaw will shift. And whenever it shifts, when you go to bed at night, you end up grinding your teeth for your teeth to match up to themselves. And it will cause, an excruciating headache. But I can pop that piece in my mouth for 3 or 4 days, you know, just at night when I go to bed, and then I'm good.
So what happened to him?
Okay, so he was tried in January. That happened in August. He was tried in January. He did plead guilty, but let a jury assess his punishment. After he found out it really was on video, that's when he decided to plead guilty because that video was pretty rough. The jury gave him 60 years.
Wow.
So in Texas, the way the law reads is, it was not a 3G offense. A 3G offense would mean they would have to serve 50% of their time day for day. But being as it did not involve a deadly weapon, it didn't fall into the 3G. So he would have to serve a quarter, but then he'd come up for parole. But he's come up for parole and he has not made it. But the rest of the story that a lot of people don't know is he's illegal. He had been in the States since he was 7. He had come over on a boat with his family. He's Cuban. So he's not a United States citizen. So if by chance he is ever released, they're taking him straight back. It'll be immediate transport back to Cuba.
Have you ever, and it's kind of a weird question, but has there been any attempt by him to apologize for his actions?
No. But it's funny that you asked that, because beforehand of me going to work for the FBI, they had me in their book anyway, and they had gone to the prison to interview him. And I have a video of it, but they talked to him in a room and they said, you know, if you could apologize to Michelle today, you know, what would you say? And he's walking, he just kind of laughed. He said, goodness. He said, well, she's fine. She healed up. She's with her family, but look at me. I'm in here. So it was all about him. He wasn't concerned, not one bit whatsoever, about my status. But he said, look, you know, she's alive. She's got her family. But look at me. I'm still here. So there's no remorse. He has.
How does that make you feel?
Glad that he's locked up. Glad that he's still where he is. And especially glad that he is not around his daughter any longer. And that was the first time in her life that she was ever going to live with her father. He was moving her to Texarkana where he lived. And he went to Houston to pick her up from grandparents. And he had an immigration hearing pending because he had just been released from Texas prison, I believe, 6 weeks before. And he picked up, all he could afford was a pound and a half of weed. He spent his money on a pound and a half of weed, picked his daughter up, brought her, was taking her back to Texarkana, which is when I stopped him. And he bought the weed so he could go back and sell it and make enough for down payment on an attorney for his immigration hearing. That never happened.
You can't make this shit up, right?
No, you can't make this shit up.
What happened with his daughter?
You know, her grandparents came from Houston and picked her up. My people never put her in with, you know, children's services or anything because she had already been through enough because she was sitting in our dispatch talking to dispatchers because the county dispatchers came over and took over the city that day and the deputies came over and took over the city to let my people go to the hospital. But they said she just sat there in the floor with colors and paper and she was sketching what appeared to be me laying on the ground because they had blue, you know, like a uniform as much as you could at 10 and then put red all the way across the face. I mean, it mentally affected her, obviously, but her grandparents drove in, got her from the station and took her back. After that, I do not know. I've tried just looking, you know, with social media and so forth these days. I've looked it up, which she could have changed her name after that. I wouldn't blame her, you know, changed her last name. I do not know. But, you know, I have all the hopes in the world that she's a fine, upstanding citizen, maybe a brain surgeon or something. You know, I hope she didn't go the opposite way from what she did have to endure that day.
I bet you'd be pretty curious to find out, right? I don't have like some surprise thing. I'm not no Maury Povich, right? This is just a podcast by some guy from Jersey who, yeah, whatever I am. But man, you've piqued my interest. Mm-hmm. And I really hope that you don't stop the journey trying to figure out whatever happened to her, because I got a funny feeling that it's probably a good story. Hopefully it's a good story. But
That's what I hope for. That's what I hope for.
Man, I wish we could help you find her. We might be able to. We got a social media guy who's pretty savage. Oh, so maybe when we finish, maybe we can have him dig around and see if we can find somebody. And just take a look. Listen, I do it sometimes. You know, I'm at a high school a lot of years now. We're not super far off in age. And I'm like, man, what happened to like 80% of the people I graduated high school with, right? Like there's a girl I graduated with. She lives in my town. We're about 40 minutes south of where we grew up. Where's everybody else? Because they're not all on Facebook. I've seen some of them on Facebook and Instagram, but where's everybody else? What happened to these people? You know, and then I think everybody does. What'd you say?
Like, it's kind of like they drop off the face of the earth or something.
Maybe when we're done with this, we can get some info from you and set us up with Nick German, who teaches our class on social media. Mm-hmm. He's a savant. He's so good that it's terrifying.
I just want to know she's okay. Yeah, you know, I wouldn't try to reach out and talk to her because I don't want to bring back a bad part in her inner life, a bad memory, but it might make it better knowing that I'm okay. I look like I'm supposed to, you know, because the last time she saw me, I was a bloody mess with an eye hanging out.
Shit. You got your vision, everything? Everything's good?
Yes. I retained 20/20.
Holy shit. Check this out, Michelle.
I have it anymore because I'm
okay.
I'm 49 years old now. So I don't have, I have reading glasses. I refuse to wear glasses, but I will wear reading glasses if I need to see a menu or read something online. I'll wear my reading glasses.
You know, for those of you listening, there is a real hard truth coming your way. And I was warned in my mid-20s that when I was 40, my vision would start to recede like everybody else's. Mm-hmm. And I am this guy now. The menu's out to here, and I have to hold it back about a foot off my face.
Well, see, the problem is my arms are not as long as they used to be. It has to be my arm shrinking, because used to I could hold the menu out in my arm, but now my arm won't go out far enough.
Wow. Does it happen like that? You're terrifying me. You're ruining my day, Michelle.
I'm sure my arm shrunk because I know my vision isn't that bad.
You're starting to scare me. I'm like, I don't.
Just wait. You can't hold it out far enough. Okay. It's coming.
I am now losing my distant vision, which I was like basically an eagle after I had LASIK done when I was 24. So the doctor said, I said, what do you think? You think I should get it done again? He goes, no, you don't. Now you're in your 40s. He's like, you don't get LASIK. He's like, now you just get fucking glasses. And I said, why? He goes, it's dangerous. He's like, you know, you're getting to your 40s. 20s is a perfect candidate. You start 40, 45. He's like, you can't start getting LASIK again. He's like, you don't want to lose your vision over this shit. Just wear glasses. I'm like, man, I got like 50 more fucking years to go. Like, what are we talking? Easy. Maybe 60.
Easy.
You could see. Nobody ever guesses the age, Michelle. Let's face it. I'm through an HD camera right now, but, you know, I have a youthful appearance. I'm not 41 looking like I'm 65. I could show you some people I went to high school with that look like they're 65 or 40.
I've seen some that years ago that I saw a picture of somebody that was younger than me in high school, and I swear they looked 70.
Nuts, right?
You know, and it was goodness, but you know, some people chose to do things that weren't good for their health either.
Most people choose to do things that aren't good for their health.
Yes.
Do you ever watch the video anymore? How many times have you watched it? Did you see it once? Have you seen it multiple times? Can you talk with it?
I've seen it a multitude of times. In fact, I speak to a group tonight, and I will show the video tonight.
When you look at it and you watch that video now, what do you think about while you're watching it?
It's strange because it's almost like third person. I mean, I know it's me. I know my mannerisms. I know when I find the dope, I know how I acted, but I have no memory trigger, not one bit whatsoever. So it really doesn't bother me because that was in days past. I'm a firm believer that everything happens for a reason. I lived through it. I wouldn't go back and undo it because I don't know where I would end up. From there, I'm happy with the way I am now. I survived. You know, maybe the reason that it happened to me was to save other people's lives. You know, and if that's the case, I am totally okay with it. You know, maybe, you know, I've had numerous people after I've spoken to groups come up to me that are going through something. And how do you do this? You know, how? And I talk to them and try to help them compartmentalize in their brain of how to overcome and how to be positive. And if that keeps somebody from taking their own life or anything else, you know, I do think it's a purpose, and it's a purpose in my life for what happened. And I survived it. I'm good. I'm going to keep being good.
What are some of the lessons learned? I'm assuming that you talk about some of this stuff from watching the video that were very, very hard lessons for you to learn. Maybe something we could be doing as law enforcement officers now to prevent things like this. And, you know, the one thing that I've written down to it is we have a course, and this is not some kind of cheap way to promote our training, but on body language and behavior. Actually, a lot of our classes talk about body language and behavior, but we have one in particular by Sean Grogan, who's our body language expert. And a lot of his class is about, you know, really understanding those signs. There's a lot of assessments of videos on our social media pages. So again, the question is, what lessons were learned and what could we be doing differently?
Yeah. You know, the sign part, I wished that I could have seen what he was doing when I was looking in the vehicle with my butt stuck up in the air and I couldn't see anything but looking for the dope. I couldn't see what he was doing, because if I had seen the motions he was making to his daughter, I would have known that something was up. But going forward, when I was going forward towards him to handcuff him, personal body space. I cannot harp enough on personal body space. Now, obviously, everyone has to get in somewhat of personal body space to handcuff, to reach the wrist. But the personal body space, the foot not up, that one foot that was not brought up next to the other one to lean over the car, that one back foot that was still hanging out, that was just a pivot point. Watch the pivot point. Another thing, back up. There is nothing wrong with waiting on somebody else. I had another officer that was within 2 miles of me. All I had to do was tell him, come over here. And right before I got hit, I did call him. So apparently, I was noticing that something wasn't okay. I don't remember. So that's the hard part. But I know my mannerisms. I know how I am. And I got on the radio. I had my shoulder mic. And I said, K-32, come over here. Then I got hit. So he was already en route to me. But it was that fast. He was the first officer to arrive. So personal body space, yes, mannerisms, absolutely. I just had very little interaction before the search and the arrest. I mean, I talked to him on the side of the road. He was as nice and compliant and cooperative as anyone could be. Then I asked to search the vehicle. So before I asked him to search the vehicle, everything was great. After that, he allowed me to. Yeah, he made a movement like towards the vehicle. I told him he could get his daughter out if he wanted to. He didn't have to, but he could. And he started going towards the driver's side and then turned around, and went to the passenger side. So it showed a little nervousness, got her out. And then that's when most of the very apparent, obvious body language happened with her, was when I got on the side of the vehicle that the dope was on. And he knew he was about to make a trip. And personal body space, once I go up to handcuff, is extremely important. And watch the feet for the pivot point to turn around, because he swung and hit me with about everything he had.
You see life any differently now versus then? What did it change about you?
Absolutely. I'm thankful for every day. I make sure I'm happy every day. I do things I want to. I help people. I still, just because I'm not in law enforcement does not mean that I don't still try to help and go speak to groups or teach classes or whatever else I do, but I do it on my time. I'm supposed to go teach one in Texas here coming up. And I'm great with that. I'm good with everything. I'm happy in life. You don't take life for granted, and you make sure that you take care of the people that may mean the most to you. My son, he's going to hear every time before he leaves that house or when he comes in or anytime else, I love you. I'm not taking anything for granted, and he knows not to as well. Just be happy with life and make the most of it. But yes, I look at life a lot different, and it's a lot more valuable because it can be taken away.
And people realize how true that is. I think anybody who unfortunately lost their life in similar circumstances would probably have the same message, because I don't think anybody ever intended to wake up and not come home.
Oh, nobody does. And I like to say that the one thing I had done prior to this, and I do attribute part of my survival to it, and I was young, and for me to have done this was pretty heads up for me, I would have to say. But you know, nobody, especially that age, thinks that something's going to happen to them. You know, it's always somebody else. Nothing's going to happen here, you know, and so forth and so on. But anybody that puts on a badge and a gun every day, something could happen to you. It can happen, especially in today's times. It's way different in today's times than it once was. But I had talked to my chief, my canine officer that was also in worked interdiction as well as me, and my husband. And I said beforehand, I said, look, if anything ever happens to me, don't worry about me. I'll be fine. But make sure that I get to Shumpert Medical Center, because, he's like family to me, but I said, my uncle's brother, Bubba, he's over radiology and he knows all the doctors there, and they're going to call Bubba and Bubba's going to get the doctors there that I need. And I said, if the ambulance or helicopter don't want to carry me, load me up in the back of a patrol car, but get me there. But don't worry about me. I'll be fine. So mentally, I was strong. And that day, it played out just exactly like it needed to, because they told him at the hospital and they made a phone call. My mother made a phone call to her brother, who made a phone call to Bubba. Anyway, so the head paramedic tells the helicopter pilot, she needs to go to Shumpert Medical Center. He said, well, I'm out of flight time. I can't fly there. I'll have to fly to Tyler. And he said, no, you fly her to Shreveport. He said, I don't have the flight time. I can't go there and get back. And I'll be, he said, look, he said, you and what Army is about to tell all those officers and family members that you're not taking her where she wanted to go. He said, you get her there. I'll make sure you get back. So they ended up flying me to Shumpert. And whenever the helicopter arrived on the helipad, Bubba already had the doctors, the eye doctor, ear, nose, and throat specialist, and neurologist, the main players on the helipad waiting. So just a simple preparation and having your mind right could make all the difference in the world. Just know you have a survival mentality.
That's awesome. And I have one last question. Mm-hmm. Who got the helicopter pilot some gas? How do you get some gas?
I don't know. I have no idea.
Because he had to get gas to fly back, right? That's what he's talking about, I imagine, right?
No, flight time.
What does that mean?
They have a certain amount of time they can be in the air.
Through FAA or something?
I guess so. I didn't know all that till then, but they have, I don't know if it's with their business, with their FAA or what, but he was out of time. And I don't know if it's like truck drivers, how they can only drive so long and have to be off the road.
Oh. I do not know.
But it was, he didn't have the flight time.
Well, I'm glad he went.
They got him back. Oh, they flew me where I wanted to go.
Well, I want to thank you for doing this today. This was great. I actually have 1,000 more questions, but because I want to go into I love the idea that you do interdiction work. I want to peel that apart. I want to talk about your career, what you meant as a major and an assistant chief, what leadership means to you. Maybe we could do this again because I have a lot more questions. Now we've covered I did the basic shit that everybody else does. Mm-hmm. I want to get into how you did your career as well, because I got a funny feeling with your great Southern sayings that is going to come out to be a really good episode where you're going to say things like, man, it was raining out there like a cow pissing on a flat rock. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. You know that saying too. That's good.
I heard it once.
Or that's when you say, well, they as about as scared of me as a possum is an axe handle.
Listen, I heard that first time in the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center when it was raining outside. It was a Georgia State Trooper. This is 2004, right? So he was one of those guys that, like, I could just see him like in the movies with the aviators on and the toothpick and like sees the New York plates. He's like, oh, that's them right there. Right. Like, so he said that and I fucking lost it. This guy he didn't crack a smile and was one of the funniest people I ever met in my life. This dude didn't ever smile once and had us all hysterical the whole time. And dude, I don't know what his name was. He taught us like traffic crashes. And I tell this story about like, taking his billy club out and like lifting somebody's chin up while they sit on the curb with the billy club. He's like, look me in the eyes, boy. And I'm like, God, I could fucking see that. This guy was, he was funny as hell. He just didn't, you would never imagine. So he started listening to him and he knew he had us all laughing, but he didn't crack ever. Never. 24 recruits in that class. We would be dying at the things he said. He didn't move. He didn't crack a smile. He just knew he was funny. And that was, I'm sure he's dead. Maybe, you know what I mean? Oh, that's 20 years ago. He was probably 65 then. He's probably dead. But hey, if you're hearing me from heaven, that guy, whoever you were fucking funny, man. Thank you for the good times. But let's do this again, if you're cool with that. I'm so glad that Sean Pardesi got us together. And, you know, if there's anything we can do for you here, this is great. And I appreciate you so much.
Well, thank you. And you never would have guessed it would be me, huh?
No, I mean, you look great.
I feel great.
It's awesome. Till next time. Guys, if you're in an area where you're trying to get to our classes, but we're not close to you, fret not. We actually have on-demand training at StreetCop.com. You can take that course online right now, and then you could attend that training in the future at no additional cost. You can redeem your voucher, so you get two for the price of one. We don't want to deny you the ability to take this training now, especially knowing that it can keep you safe, at a very minimum, putting bad guys in jail where they belong, and at the maximum, going home to your family. Check out StreetCop.com for that offer.
Hey, how y'all?
For police officer Michelle Jeter, this widespread lack of respect for authority had tragic consequences. On August 10th, 1997, Jeter pulled over a speeding van on Highway 59 just outside of Carthage, Texas.
There's that barely fit in here, didn't it?
Her patrol car's dash camera recorded the entire incident on tape. Jeter had no idea that the situation and the van's driver, Jorge Orozco, would soon go out of control.
Conversation was very lax. He was, you know, real cordial, real polite. But as far as traffic stop, it was going, you know, really perfect. It really was.
Although a routine check of Orozco's license turned up an outstanding traffic warrant, Officer Jeter was unaware that he had recently served time for armed assault.
For some reason, I asked him if I could have permission to search the vehicle, and he said, sure, no problem.
At that point, Orozco's 8-year-old daughter stepped out of the van and waited by the side of the road. Jeter's search of the van eventually turned up a pouch containing 1.5 pounds of marijuana.
Put your hands on the car. Huh? Put your hands on the car. On that car over there.
I stepped away from his vehicle, walked to the back of the van, and advised him to place his hands on the car. He went in a motion as he was going to cooperate. And as I stepped forward with my handcuffs and my hand to handcuff him, he spun around and hit me in the face.
Michelle Jeter was immediately knocked unconscious. She has no recollection of the savage beating that followed, in full view of Jorge Orozco's daughter.
Go, baby, I can't go to jail. Go, baby.
Orozco drove away, leaving Michelle to die by the side of the road. A passing motorist rushed to Jeter's side and used her police radio to call for help.
Help, officer down!
Michelle was rushed to the nearest hospital, where she was placed on life support systems and lay in a coma for 6 days. Her assailant was captured within an hour of the brutal assault. And although Michelle has no memory of the attack, she has viewed it on tape.
His intentions, in my opinion, were to kill me. You know, you deserve this because I can't go back to jail. That's just your tough luck. You got in my way. I don't believe that I will ever be able to forgive him. That's something that has affected my life forever. And I'm sure it's something that has affected his daughter's life forever. and I can't forgive him for me or for her.
Jorge Orozco was convicted of attempted murder and sentenced to 60 years in prison without the possibility of parole. For Michelle Jeter, justice was served.